Coming to you live from the gullet of a Tyrusian bile worm, I'm Johannes Stauffer, and with me, as always, is the partially digested husk of the man I once loved. And this is the Mildly Alarming Podcast. Episode 62, The Gleaming Golden Cornfields of My Youth.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Mildly Alarming Podcast. My name is Tom, as always.
And I'm Johannes Stauffer, as occasionally.
Well, I was looking at our notes for what we wanted to talk about this week and, you know, all of the stuff we have planned. And I got to say, we've got a really great show lined up.
We really do plan ahead.
Like, I was wondering, though, how exactly did you get The Rock to come on our show?
He prefers Dwayne.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And, you know, I ran into him at the gym as he was bench pressing me. And, you know, he's into games and he thought it might be interesting. So here he is, everyone. Dwayne The Rock Johnson.
Right. So our topic for this week are, well, for the first segment of the show at any rate, are the different sorts of players that you encounter in your board gaming lives as you make your way through that cardboard paradise we all know and love so much. The different sorts of people that you meet.
When you're walking down the street, they're the people that you meet. Each day.
Dee-da-dee-da day? Is it that song? Is that the reference you're making?
I'm talking about Sesame Street. What are you talking about?
Oh, that one Queen song?
No, that's different. That's but I guess that has also people on streets. Dee-da-dee-da. Fair enough.
That's where I thought you were going with it.
Yeah, you were wrong. As is frequently, in fact, always the case.
Well, you know.
Take it away, Tom.
Right. So, I thought this was interesting because one of the things you note if you make your way through life migrating from board game group to board game group is that you see the same cast of characters repeat itself over and over again, much like how the humor of this podcast repeats itself over and over again. So I thought it would be interesting to talk about the different folks you meet and possibly gain some insight into how one might make games to take these different personalities that virtually every gaming group is going to encounter into account as you're making them.
Provided you have enough friends to run into these people, which actually we don't.
No. Not really. It's kind of sad, really.
Yeah, it's just
We're actually not us, even, in fact. We're I. We record this, each side of the conversation separately, and then stack it. We're just very good at voices, it turns out.
I like that you're still using we.
Well, I wouldn't want to give away the game. Moving right along. So probably the most common species of board gamer that people are familiar with and that is one of the more readily identifiable ones that everybody spots right away is analysis paralysis guy.
Yep.
You know, this creature, it lives in fetid swamps where it dines primarily on various types of cheese. And it takes, how much time would you say it takes to take a given turn?
It has yet to be recorded because it's still going on.
The turn has not yet ended.
Yeah.
Right.
It's like The Dark Knight Returns.
Oh, yeah. We should probably not be recording in the middle of that.
Because, yeah.
We're still in the theater watching
that movie.
When
did we go, you know?
When it came out.
Like, yeah, a year and a half ago or something.
I don't know. I've lost track of time in this dark theater.
It hasn't ended yet.
It's still going.
It's the longest thing ever made. We're saying that the movie was too long. Analysis paralysis player makes you feel the way I feel about The Dark Knight Returns, you know, about their godforsaken turn.
You know, it's funny that you never saw Interstellar, because that was a long movie, too.
That's what I hear. I'm waiting for The Dark Knight Returns to end before I go start another film.
Another film that will never end, that will take the rest of your natural life.
I don't have the attention span for two at a time.
It's hard to podcast when some kid is kicking the back of your seat.
That's true.
Because he was born and grew up watching The Dark Knight Returns, or Rises, or whatever it's called.
I don't know either. He knows nothing else.
You might say, that while we only adopted the darkness,
oh, he God. Was...
that was worth it.
That can't be forgiven. Bad show, Tom. Bad show.
It's going to be a great show. The Rock is
good
here.
Show, Peter. Did you ever see Hook?
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, I think that's what he says.
Okay, we'll go
but
with
I
it.
But I can't do a good guy who played Hook impression.
I don't know who that was either.
It was that one guy.
No, it's not the guy who played Long John Silver in Muppet Treasure Island, because that's Tim Curry.
Yeah. It's not Tim Curry. He would have been an okay Hook, though.
Oh, crap. The name is on the tip of my tongue of the guy who played
Rain
Hook.
He's Rain Man.
Dustin Hoffman?
Yes, Dustin Hoffman.
Really?
Yep.
Huh.
Good form, Peter.
So it wasn't on the tip of your tongue at all?
No, not even close.
No. You were going to say George Wendt, weren't you?
Probably.
Yeah.
So that's my go-to actor.
Yeah.
So, are we talking about board games tonight?
I thought maybe, I guess.
Okay, fair enough. But anyway, analysis paralysis guy takes forever.
You can remember it because it rhymes.
Right. It's like a rap song.
So analysis paralysis player.
Yeah.
What is that, Tom?
Well, we've been through this like four times now. That it's a player whose turns take her long enough. But the thing is that it's almost a misnomer, or at least a misleading nomer, because there's a variety of reasons that a turn might take literally an eternity. One, and the one that the analysis paralysis moniker would indicate, is when there is so much going on the board and you have so many options and so many variables and so many things to keep track of that you can't make a decision. You have to analyze such a large volume of data to make an informed choice that you are paralyzed by all of that analyzing.
I was going to make an analyze joke, and then I thought, no, I'll be good. Or have to edit it out later. And then you went and made it anyway.
We kind of do the whole classy cop, disgusting cop thing.
Yeah, that's true.
Classy cop, trashy cop?
Yeah, that's good.
That works.
So I actually have never really thought of the analysis paralysis player as a moniker for players whose turns take forever until right this second. And now in retrospect, a lot of times that you've used that term make a lot more sense to me.
What did you think I was talking about?
Well, I always assumed it only meant someone whose turns take forever because they are analyzing their turn. But like Gary's turns take a long time, and it's not always analysis paralysis. Sometimes it's just because you do things at a lower speed than the rest of the world around you.
Yeah, that's true. You might just have a lower rate of movement.
Shout out to Gary.
Hey, Gary. Gary is our friend. We like Gary.
Gary may or may not like us less with each new episode.
Oh, well, you know. So what do you think, for as a designer, can you take AP guy, analysis paralysis guy, and into consideration and build your game around that? Or are you just sort of, you're out of luck?
Well, I would say that you can really only take the very narrow definition of analysis paralysis, the guy who's actually thinking through his turn into account, because at least you can say, okay, let's try not to make the turns too involved. So that guy doesn't get bogged down by trying to keep track of so many things.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we keep going back to the relatively few games we play, but I think actually Eclipse, even with all of the resource management and stuff that you have to do, does a pretty good job of making it simple so analysis paralysis guy doesn't get bogged down in it, because mm-hmm. you got little things to move and everything's fairly compartmentalized, and so it's not too bad.
So having Eclipse, one of the things I've always been really impressed by with it is how succinctly it visually shows you what you've got,
mm-hmm.
what you've got available, what you can do, and how. So that's definitely good if you can make it easy to see the data the analysis paralysis person wants. That's definitely helpful. I agree with that.
Provided they're a visual person, and they probably are. If they're getting, again, the most literal interpretation of an analysis paralysis, if that's their problem, yeah.
Right.
Being able to visualize it all at once is probably a good thing. We run into these players that are real slow on other games that I guess you would call analysis paralysis, but they really aren't. If you're taking a long, long time on a turn in Dominion, it's probably not because you have a whole lot to think about. You might have a little bit to think about, or you may come down to like, oh, I should have thought about what card I actually wanted to buy this turn. But that's mostly just, yeah, you should have thought about what card you wanted to buy this turn before it was this turn.
That actually kind of bleeds a little bit into our next one on the list, ADD player. Nothing yeah. against the afflicted with the lack of attention or the deficit of it.
You're just afraid because I'm sitting right across the table.
I am. You're sitting across the table and you're holding a machete. But occasionally, late in the evening, as the... I forget what ADD meds are called, so I'm just going to go with crystal meth starts to wear off.
It's pretty much crystal meth.
More or less. You find that their turns begin to extend in length because they've been watching the truck go by across the street out the window, and also they've taken all of their clothes off for reasons that are clear only to themselves.
It's warm in there. I don't remember why I did it either.
But, yeah. You know, that's another thing. If the play, I don't know what you do about the players that never pay attention, but...
Well, I mean, that's a fair point. Is the ADD player, for the sake of discussion, someone who actually has ADD? Which, in our gaming experience, generally is, because you've got me, and you've got Alfonso, and you've got occasional others.
Mm-hmm.
Or is it just a good, about as accurate as analysis paralysis, but at least useful term for the... guy who stops paying attention, who's, you know, playing around with their phone or right. whatever it is.
The person who really you kind of had to talk into playing in the first place.
Yeah.
And they aren't really all that invested in the game to begin with. Yeah.
Or you've tried to get them invested in a game that everyone else knows how to play, but not all of those people are all that invested in teaching the new person how to play.
Yeah.
So they don't really have a choice.
That's definitely a problem.
That happens a lot. That's why I don't enjoy Catan at all. And won't play it, even though it might actually be good. I'll never find out. I'll literally never find out, because the first time I tried to play Catan, people are like, we won't just destroy you, we'll teach you how to play. And then they just destroyed me, and I'm like, I don't have even the rule book in front of me to try to learn this game. Mm-hmm. While you guys who've been playing it for years are playing, I certainly also don't have the focus to do that, so just whatever. I'm not playing this game with you anymore.
You know, that ties into a broader thing. And another topic we talked about doing this week that I forgot about until just now, and that is teaching board games to other people and how you go about showing other people how to enjoy this hobby that you have because you stopped growing up like Peter Pan at some point. And that's true. If you don't teach them well, you often get that person who is just not enjoying it and is kind of ruining it for everybody else by not paying attention. And that's kind of important, I think. If you don't teach them effectively, you... don't have people to play with, because they'll only play with you that one time.
You effectively generate the ADD player or you know, types we haven't gotten to yet, the angry player,
mm-hmm.
because you didn't take the time to actually get them invested in the game, and you may have ruined that person on that game too.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I will not play Catan. I don't, you know, maybe it's great. I'll never know. And I'll never know because I don't want to anymore. But like, we have friends who won't play Resistance or Avalon or what was the other one? It was all three games that we played in one night. And she was like, I just don't... that's a bad game. I don't want to play.
Coup
might have been one. Oh, King of Tokyo was the other one.
Really? Who didn't want to play King of Tokyo?
I was...
because you're going to bring up their name just on the air here, yeah.
Who was just like, yeah, I don't like those games. Those games are bad. And I don't know that they... really wouldn't like those games, because I played other games with them that were really similar that they enjoyed, but they had a bad experience of that one game that one time,
mm-hmm.
their first time. And so they're like, no, that's a bad game. I don't like it.
Yeah, yeah.
So you may have a player who you think is distracted or whatever, but really they just, you know, they've been kind of burned on Catan or on Dominion or on whatever it is that you're playing. And
part of that, you know, I think part of the reason that oftentimes getting burned on a game, you know, burns so vigorously is that, you know, if you have a bad board game, you're having a bad 45 minutes to an hour and a half and up.
Yeah.
You know, so if that's a completely miserable experience for you, yeah, you're not coming back to that. You don't have that much free time. We've met. I know you. You don't.
So moving on to the next one, we talked about the angry player.
Yeah, that guy's so mad all the time.
Actually, do we want to talk about trying to design for the ADD player? Can you?
No, not really. I mean, if somebody's not invested in the game, there's not much you can do.
Yeah, doesn't really even matter if they're not invested because they actually have attention deficit hyperactive disorder, or if they just aren't interested.
Right. I mean, if they're riding the ADD train, you know, you just got to hope they play when their meds are on. more or less, or when they're, I don't know, do you have focused spells when you're particularly focused? Or?
By the time in the day that we are playing board games, I've usually used all my spell slots.
Oh, fair enough.
Yeah, and none of those spells are, you know, cantrips, so...
Somewhere your brothers just greased up their wedgieing gloves.
gross. But now I can tell them they were called out in this podcast and they have to listen to it.
There you go. See? Angry players.
Yep.
So, this is, like, I mean, we've got angry player and then right after that we've got competitive player, which I think are distinct.
And I think are occasionally distinct.
All right, hit me with why you think they're occasionally distinct.
Well, let's say what we think. Well, let's say what you think angry and competitive player are, and maybe I will retract my.
I mean, the angry guy isn't necessarily out for blood in the game, but he's gonna lose his mind over trivial stuff.
Oh no, I think I get it. Is this the guy who, like, I'm not gonna attack Harold over there because he's gonna freak out about it?
Yeah.
That guy.
Like angry guy might not be out for blood. He might not be paying that much attention, but you gotta kind of watch what you do around him.
Sure.
Because, like, he's a ticking time bomb. I mean, why did you invite angry guy?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it ties back. You can mitigate him a little bit if you've taught the game well,
mm-hmm.
because nothing makes angry guy matter than if his brilliant move that he's been planning for 4.5 turns turns out to be illegal and he didn't know it.
So now I think you've made angry guy competitive guy.
Okay, I can see that. Yeah, I can see the overlap there.
Because angry guy, I would say, is the guy who is going to be vindictive when you do things to him. And maybe he doesn't even understand the game. It doesn't really matter. He's mm-hmm. the guy who's playing, kind of like we talked about, that way of playing Eclipse or that way of playing competitive games. That's like, I'm going to make someone cry. I'm out to ruin someone's day right now,
mm-hmm.
more than just to win the game. I think that's that guy, where competitive guy might be the one who is planning 5 turns ahead, and then you're like, actually, the rules don't... actually, the rules don't allow that. And then they become angry guy.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a little bit of overlap there, I think that's two different things.
It's kind of a Bruce Banner, Incredible Hulk situation. The mild-mannered competitive guy, when prodded properly, becomes the throbbing green angry guy.
Throbbing was an interesting choice of words.
I was happy with it.
Yeah, okay.
You know.
Gross.
I mean, competitive guy... I mean, part of the thing you run into with... I think the overlap between competitive guy and angry guy, too, is that if you take competitive guy into a game where you can't really be competitive in, like King of Tokyo,
mm-hmm.
where luck is so central and you can't even really plan around what's going on. Like, there's usually an optimal move based on the role you got, but you mm-hmm. have so little control over the role you got that, whatever. You know, there's no point in competing at King of Tokyo.
Well, really. I mean, there's some point because it's completely competitive no matter what you do.
Yeah, but I'm saying that you don't have enough control over what you do to care about the outcome, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I can, at the very core of the game.
Yeah, I mean, you can
end up with cards where you can be angry guy a little bit or just be vindictive, you know, be the ones that let you make, you have to re-roll that 3, sucker.
Yeah, a little bit, but I think it's so, you can be angry guy, certainly, yeah. You can produce that guy, but I don't think you can really be competitive guy over it because what are you going to... You can optimize how often what you reroll and whatnot. You can kind of make that decision, but ultimately,
yeah.
It's so completely random by the dice are so much a part of it that I don't know that there's really anywhere to go.
So I think you're making competitive player sort of conniving almost. Where the,
I hate that guy.
Well, right, but the hyper competitive player isn't always like, I'm going to plan 4.5 turns ahead because I'm really excited to see how I can really ruthlessly destroy you. Sometimes it's the guy who's just like, I'm going to attack you. I'm going to attack you again. Like, you're destroying my ships every time, and I'm going to keep throwing them at you. Like, you're defeating my armies. You're whatever. But I'm going to keep attacking you because...
I have to eventually win?
Yeah.
Isn't that... Sounds more like dumb player to me.
Yeah.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, I guess I could see it, though. He's got to... He gets hyper-focused on a smaller part of the game and doesn't... See the big picture or whatnot?
I wonder almost if competitive is just not a useful word in this context, because the competitive player in the context of a every man for himself, like a non-cooperative board game,
uh-huh.
you need to be competitive. If you're not being competitive, you're the player who loses.
Listen, I compiled this list after extensive and exhaustive research and development, so I would appreciate it if you respected the time I put into it.
Did you compile this list like in 3 minutes on your lunch break? Or, well, you should have been working. We'll say lunch break.
Yeah, we'll go with lunch break.
So, designing for the angry player and the competitive player, are they worthwhile, and are there things that we can do for them?
Our next one is a rules lawyery player. This guy has a Juris Doctorate from...
I like how you turned sort of Scottish, but not quite
I didn't know where I was going, but I went for it, and then I saw no graceful escape, so, you know, now that's on the internet forever, so yay. But this guy's got a JD from Board Gaming University, and he wants to tell you all about the nuances of the interpretations of the rules and how they interact and how things actually are. And, you know, you got to get down to the nitpickiness of it, the very, very deep places of the rules, and really dig the crunch out of them. I think this guy is more evident in, like, tabletop RPGs, like the D&Ds and the other ones, and in your miniatures games, like your Warhammers and your Battletechs and your Star Wars the X-Wing Rogue fighter playing.
Hero clicks? I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm just saying words.
Your hero clicks, your mage knights, your... my nose itches. It's pretty rough over here. Anyway.
That was a disgusting noise. I'm leaving that in.
But yeah, so you got that guy. You know, they're gonna argue every point. They're going to really just want to debate how the system works with you.
So that was, before you even said it, I was thinking, this sounds like the sort of thing that comes up mostly in an RPG or a tabletop of greater than general board game proportions. Is this something that you've ever seen in a more board game?
No, not really, but I think that's mainly because I'm usually in the position of teaching board games in a lot of cases, and I have the rule book, and I keep it strictly under my own thumb so that I can cheat.
Horrifyingly enough, is the person who board games with us who has the greatest focus among our group. So you can imagine how much we actually get done on a given board gaming day.
It's a rough situation.
It's not a whole lot.
No, it's not. It's not very much. But no, I usually have the rule book, and I'm usually the one adjudicating those disputes to some degree or another. So I've never really encountered, unless I am that guy. I might be that guy. I don't know. Well, the other thing is that I've always taken a cue from D&D, where if you have a dispute and it lasts more than, like, if it lasts at all, like if it actually escalates to a dispute about the rules, you roll it, you assign a value to each option, roll a dice, and move on.
Or rocks fall and everyone dies.
Or you know, just sort of lose your mind a little bit and throw everybody out of your house and
okay, go from this there. Story is happening now.
What story? No.
Oh, you know.
No.
You know.
No, not that story.
Come on.
I don't know which story you're talking about.
You gotta know. All right. So when we were in high school, Tom DM'd a campaign for us, a Dungeons & Dragons campaign for me, and how what was the standard number of people in the campaign? 5, 6?
I think it averaged 5 or 6, yeah.
So at any rate, one of our players later in the game was the younger brother of a good friend of Tom's from childhood, and this was building and building. Like, we're probably, what, 3 years into the campaign?
It was an epic saga.
It wasn't 4, because I think we came back after this, but it was pretty, like, the story had been building for a while, and we finally get to, like, the end boss, the big, you know, epic monologue and presumably fight that was supposed to end, like, wrap up the whole campaign storyline, and the younger brother figure, who's always been more than a little antagonistic to Tom in an annoying little brother kind of way, says something like, So we're facing this elder brain thing, and none of us, except for maybe one person, knows what an elder brain is. And he's like, I shoot it with an arrow. Right? Didn't he shoot it, or did he walk up and stab it?
I don't remember if he shot it or stabbed it. I don't remember what the in-story reasoning was, but it basically had one, like, a hit point at that point. It was supposed to deliver its final monologue and die.
Okay.
As I recall.
I've never even known that much.
Yeah, because elder brains in the backstory are unbelievably powerful. Unbelievably powerful. So it should have just wrecked your business.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, because at that point you were on, like, the third or fourth generation of characters. Like,
yeah.
There had been it was a complicated story. There had been a group of characters earlier who could have beaten it because they had already gone to the Abyss and killed the Queen
of the
Demons. They
had become some godlike... Yeah. They were NPCs. We weren't allowed to play them anymore.
Yeah, I was like, okay, now I can't write for this group anymore because I don't have monsters for you to fight. And I'm not that creative. But so it was a new group, and they had gone and found it, and they were supposed to be able to... This brain had been greatly weakened for some reason, and I don't remember why, what my reason was, because I didn't take great notes on it. But he was able to kill it in one blow. It was supposed to deliver an evil monologue about stuff, and then... Bleh.
So this is the sort of thing, and I imagine a part of this was just building bitterness over the fact that Tom would spend probably hours, if not more, writing these wonderful campaign settings for us to play in with NPCs and experiences we were supposed to have and role play through and combat and everything, and we would go in a totally different direction than he expected almost every night we played, and he would have to just wing it, like fly by the seat of his pants, and he did a tremendous job of it, but we were just a really annoying party, I'm sure, to have to DM for. And so he's got this like final wrap up, this epic storyline monologue all ready to go, and Chimpy goes, I shoot it. Like, well, it's in mid sentence, and Tom's like, really? You shoot it? He's like, yeah, I shoot it. And we're like, no, shut up. You don't shoot it. And it's like, no, I totally do. So he shot it, and it had one hit point, so it died. And we're just like, so what happened? And Tom's just like, it's dead. You'll never know. We're done. And we went home and never knew.
one of the better parts of that story, too, is that no one will ever know how that plot line ended because I have forgotten and I didn't write anything down.
We live in a horrific nightmare world.
It is a bad world.
So that story, I feel, leads pretty well into our next player type, unless we want to talk about how to write for the rules lawyer. But I don't think there's really any way around them.
I think by keeping your rules simple and straightforward, using plenty of examples, and I think just a good way to do it is to include elements in the rules that point out, hey, if you run into a dispute, here is a dispute resolution mechanism, whether it's rolling a die or having a rule that trumps all others or something like that.
Yeah, we've actually tended to take a sort of opposite approach to that, and we've never really seen it playtested all that expansively, so maybe it doesn't work, but there are a lot of things where, like, determine first player, we just go with by any mutually agreeable means.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a cop-out on our part, but really that's not a super important mechanic, and it gets rid of the rules lawyer being like, actually, I should be the first player because I won when I played with a different group of people 2 months ago, and that's the most recent victory, so I'm going to start now.
Mm-hmm.
I have a lot of respect for the rules lawyer, as you can tell.
Clearly. You know, and you know, with that first player mechanic or mechanics like that, I tend to like just throwing it to the players and they can pick however they want to do it, because even mechanics that are ostensibly like lighthearted, like love letters, where it's
whoever went on a date last,
aside from pointing out which of your group of players is the saddest in life and promoting a lot of awkward silences, I'm gonna digress in a minute here.
Okay.
So, you know, you've just got to go around the table and think, okay, which one of us was on a date last? Blah blah blah. It's kind of boring.
Yeah.
Or like another mechanic where whoever's birthday was most recent. No, nobody wants to sit and figure that out when you're playing a board game. Just throw some d6s. High roller goes first. Oh, I was gonna digress a little bit. There's a game I don't think you and I have talked about at all, called Dog Eat Dog.
Mm-hmm.
It's this very rules light theater of the mind role playing game where one player takes on the role of the occupying country. It's about colonialism, so it's real dark.
Okay.
Of the occupier, and the rest of the players are natives.
Mm-hmm.
And basically you role play out the natives existing under occupation here. But I bring it up because its way of determining who will be the one player controlling the entire occupying species or race or whatever, and who, and the other players will all have to control individual natives. The way they pick that is it's the actual wealthiest player who gets to be the occupier.
That gets awkward fast.
Yeah, so right off the bat in this game, you have to have this incredibly awkward conversation where you turn to all of your friends and go, okay, which one of us is the wealthiest here? Anyone want to jump in on that?
Yeah, what's your salary?
Yeah, what's your salary? How's your 401k doing there, buddy?
Plus, you know, it's really unfair to people like Bill Gates because they only ever get to play one side of the game.
True.
Unfair.
But I actually, you know, it's kind of a flip side on that one, because I actually kind of like that mechanic, because the game is supposed to make you uncomfortable in that way. You're supposed to feel that power differential between the occupier and the occupied. Mm-hmm. And if you're immediately made uncomfortable by thinking, oh, man, my friend Gary makes way more money than me.
No, he doesn't.
We don't know what Gary does in his
free time. That's true. Okay, fair enough.
It immediately leads into the game. So I don't want to sound like, you know, with dismissing or with just throwing it to the players with, oh, whatever's mutually agreeable, like that's a end-all, be-all solution. If there's a solution that if the rules make sense for what you're doing, go with them. But you can short-circuit the rules lawyer and the competitive guy a little bit by explicitly throwing things and saying, we don't have a solution for this, just whatever works for your group is fine.
So speaking of D&D and our fun story and the one guy who had memorized the monster manuals, that was my first experience with the term min-maxer, which is our next player type that we're going to discuss. Tom, what's a min-maxer?
I'm glad you asked, Johannes, because...
You're welcome.
We kind of got to define it, I guess, yeah. for the listener that isn't already familiar with the term. But anyway, min-maxer is the player who minimizes all numbers that should be minimized and maximizes all numbers that should be maximized. They look to have the highest possible numerical advantage at all times. So if your ability to get punched in the face should be a high number, they will try to find the way within the rules to make that number as high as possible. If your ability to dodge a thrown brick should be a low number, they will make that number as low as they can get it.
Mm-hmm.
They will go through the book, every book available to it. They'll go through the decks of cards. They'll run the numbers. They will make spreadsheets. They will figure that business out. They will discuss it at length on internet forums. And, they will have that available to them.
I don't know how much discuss... I mean, yeah, okay. So there are min-maxers who are min-maxers on purpose. And will metagame and net deck and whatever else you want to call it to really try to create the most unstoppable character they can in any given game. And I think min-maxy play kind of comes into play a lot more in RPG style mm-hmm. games than more traditional board games where there's a lot more restrictive rules. But I would say that min-maxing is something that you tend to do. That's basically how a player is going to start, because you look at it and you say, well, you know, this number should be low. I don't need that score, so I'll put the low ones there or whatever. Mm-hmm. And this one needs to be really good, so I'm going to do that. And it's only later, you know, going back to Dungeons and Dragons, it's only later that you really appreciate that, you know, I created this character who, yeah, like maybe he's a thief, but he's also naturally clumsy, so I need to give him a low dex score, even mm-hmm. though he's supposed to be a thief, because I don't want to just pass all the time, all my saves. I need the character to be realistic. So it's kind mm-hmm. of understandable at first, in
yeah.
my mind.
Yeah, I mean, and definitely, it's even understandable later on. I mean, nobody wants to play... you know, the fighter who can't hit anything, or the mm-hmm. wizard who can never cast a spell because he's kind of dim. You know, that's legitimately if not min-maxed, at least a character who's completely unoptimized at all isn't going to be any fun to do.
Mm-hmm.
Where I think the min-maxer becomes a problem is when... that's fine, don't worry about it. There was just a mysterious noise from my kitchen, and it's fine. There's nothing to worry about whatsoever.
There's no one with an axe or a ski mask... or hockey mask.
Oh, no, there's a guy with an axe and a ski mask and a hockey mask in there.
Do you live in the refrigerator?
Yeah, just don't worry about
okay,
it.
Okay, all right, I'm not worried then.
Where it becomes a problem, where the min-maxer becomes a problem is when, you know, you try to mix the peanut butter that is min-maxing with the rainbow sherbet that is just sort of casual play.
I just threw up a little bit in my mouth.
Yeah, it doesn't taste good. It's like... if you and I and Alphonse and Gary sit down to play Dominion, for example,
mm-hmm.
And then we invite Clorenzo over, and Clorenzo plays a lot of Dominion and net decks Dominion. He goes online and he talks about Dominion. He knows exactly what he's doing for any given spread of Dominion cards. Clorenzo's going to wipe the floor with us, mm-hmm. and those games are going to end quickly, and it's just not going to be much fun.
Yeah, I played that game. I told you about that.
Last time
we played Dominion, we did one of the pre-built decks that was, what? You had a card that lets you throw away cards, and I told you about the guy who we played with who basically built the most lean like efficient deck I've ever seen to and just annihilated us in a few turns.
Right, right.
And then we all spent three games trying to figure out how to do that and never did.
Nah, we really didn't. It was...
But we had fun doing it. We casually did that.
And it, all of the players at the table, I think, have to be on the same page with what you're trying to get out of the game. And you can't be too far out of sync in terms of skill. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it's like playing chess against somebody who's way out of your league. It's just, you're not learning anything and it's not fun.
Mm-hmm.
So why bother?
Yeah.
You know,
or playing Catan with people who have played Catan before.
Yeah, seriously, you should give it another try. It's fun.
I won't.
It's worth playing. Like, no, it's not the end-all, be-all of board games, but it is a fun game.
Listen, if you buy enough liquor, I'll give it another try.
I don't know that
you
I want
to... You gotta buy it for me, though. You can't just buy liquor and eventually...
Oh, okay.
Yeah. It's not helpful.
Fair enough. You know, it kind of... The idea that the players need to be on the same page, that kind of relates to a theory of learning that is out there in the mm-hmm. world, or maybe that I'm making up. I can't remember if this is the one that I just think is true or one that's actually true. But, it goes something like, you need to hit people when you're trying to teach them something with challenges that are both a little bit above and a little bit below where they can do consistently.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you go too far below, obviously you're not learning anything, you're just doing really easy stuff. And if you go too far above, you get discouraged. But if you get a few that are above that are just difficult enough that they have to really strive to hit them, and a few that are easy enough that they have to pay attention,
mm-hmm.
but they can do it consistently, that's the best. That's where the sweet spot, the target where you want most of your stuff to fall, most of your things they're trying to you're trying to do. Your
challenges that you need them to overcome.
Challenges
you
need them to overcome, tasks to perform, whatever. And I think that's similar in board gaming with the different outcome of players having fun. The challenges need to fall into that same kind of spectrum. You need some that are just easy enough that you can kind of do them.
Mm-hmm.
They're not super easy, trivial, but they're not hard.
Yeah.
And some that you really need to buckle down and focus on in order to, I think, maximize your fun value, which is what this is about, is taking that number and just driving it as far up as you can, your fun quotient.
Yeah, I think this, I'm going to sidetrack us a little bit. We talked about this earlier today. I came across for the first time ever the term Ameritrash today, and I already heard Eurogame as sort of a concept, but I'd never really bothered to figure out what exactly that meant. Like, I knew what some Eurogames were, but I didn't know the exact, you know, this makes a Eurogame, this makes a, apparently the opposite is Ameritrash. But that sort of are you playing for fun or are you playing to win? And like, you can play both game styles in both ways. But the way I ran across the explanation of both of them was really, the Euro games really got pushed into a camp that was like, chess is sort of the far end of this spectrum. Like, this game is not really so much for casual enjoyment as it is about learning how to make all of the mechanics and metrics work the best and most efficiently for you to destroy your opponent. And what they call Ameritrash, which I'm told isn't supposed to be offensive, but certainly sounds that way, as someone who enjoys those games at any rate, is a lot more experiential. And it's about the theme, and there's a lot of randomness to it. And so maybe even if you think you've gamed it just right, you roll the dice and it screws you over, or you draw a card and rocks falls and everyone dies and Cthulhu eats your face, you kind of run into that. Why are you playing the game? And I guess you can't really... That sort of shows that there's these two big main genres of games, and people really like both of them, and some individuals really like both types of game.
Mm-hmm.
So when you get down to designing a game, is it even worth taking the min-maxer into account? Because really, effectively, as we've defined it, the person who decides to get really good at chess or Catan or Carcassonne or whatever is just a min-maxer. They're just a super good min-maxer because mm-hmm. that's what those games invite as far as like tournament play or whatever.
Right. I think you're right that, you know, you to some degree can't take them into account because they're going to exist and they're going to do their thing. Where mm-hmm. you want to take them into account, I think, and where I've tried to with my spreadsheets when we're doing design work, is you want to be sure that there's no sort of dominant strategy that they can find and that will just make everything else completely irrelevant.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if there's a way that you can consistently every time win in a couple of turns, I mean, why bother playing then?
Do you not then, as a game designer, have to be a min-maxer at heart in order to make a game?
You at least have to be able to put on that hat and think that way, yeah. I think. You've got to be able to go through and find the different strategies, the different approaches, and see which ones are going... And then decide, is this just a very good way to play the game, mm-hmm. or is this dominant to the point of damaging fun? Like, there was... I don't remember what it was, but there was this... computer game that my old roommate Steve, we'll go with, because that's his real name, and I used to play all the time, and there was this one spell he had. I can't remember what the game was called, unfortunately. There's this one spell he had that, or he would consistently draw or get or whatever, that was pretty dominant. Like, there wasn't much you could do if he got it, and there wasn't much he had to do to get it other than get it. It just sort of showed up now and again, and I remember being really frustrated with it, and eventually I stopped playing the game altogether, because I'm like, why bother? That spell is so good. When you get it, you've won. I remember another roommate of mine said, well, it sounds like you should just get that spell then. I'm like, you're entirely missing the point of what I'm saying here. It's like, if there is, you're like, you're right, if you are talking about I want to win the game, you should get that spell. But if you're talking about I want to play a game that is interesting, or even differently, I want to design a game that a lot of people will have a lot of fun times playing, you got to get rid of that spell, because it's just not fun.
Yeah, and we used to play a lot of Mario Kart for the Wii, and there was that one bike. Once you've unlocked all of the vehicles, there was that one bike. I think it's the Magic Cruiser that Gary would always use, that I just came to call the cheater bike, because it is better than every other vehicle in every way. It's faster off-road, it's faster on-road, its acceleration is better. It's just like, it's just this crazy, ridiculous bike, and Gary would always play it and win, and I was like, I this isn't fun.
Right.
Stop doing that. Just don't use that bike anymore. And like, I understand that he didn't want to, because I owned the game and played it more than everyone else, so I would destroy everyone else just through hours of gameplay over what everyone else had experientially.
Right.
And so that's not entirely fair, but at the same time, like, if the argument was, well, no, I should have just used the Magic Cruiser also, but that's not fun, because then my hours of arguably wasted time getting really good at this computer game are compounded by this ridiculous cheater bike that are just better than everything else. And I, of course, I'm going to destroy everyone. It just wasn't fun. And so no one else used it, but Gary would always use it anyway.
Well, too, the other thing that does is that if the solution to that problem is, well, just everybody should ride the cheater bike, well, then suddenly you've said that all of the other vehicles available in the game are pointless once the cheater bike is unlocked. Now, you've created a game that has one bike in it. It's either ride the cheater bike or consistently lose.
Yeah.
That's not interesting
anymore. So we should probably move on.
Next player type. What's the next one on the list?
Too cool to be there.
Yeah, that guy's too cool to be there. Like, he doesn't want to play board games because he's a grown-up, and I don't know.
I feel like this is a pretty straightforward one. Like, maybe don't play board games with that guy.
Yeah. Next one.
For f***'s sake, you guys! Or alternatively, the cardboard quarterback. So, something that I've been told that we should be ashamed about, that we've brought up before, is that our gateway drug to board games, and still one of my favorite board games of all time, is apparently a staple of Ameritrash games, Arkham Horror.
I want to make a very clear statement.
Okay.
Can I make a very clear statement?
I don't know yet. We'll find out.
Arkham Horror is f***ing awesome.
Amen to that.
Yeah.
It's great. And one of the things that we love about it is that there are all these things available to you to make the game different. Among them, a tool which I'll have to link to in the comments, because I forget what it's called offhand. But there's a whole...
It was Strange Eons.
Strange Eons. I will still link to it, but now you know what it's called. It's a tool to let you create item cards and character cards and basically every paper component of the game as if you want to. And so we started off, the guys over at Penny Arcade released a couple that we printed off and used Gabe and Tycho cards that are pretty great. I actually made a Thomas Kemper card, which is their little cat, as an ally card. Mm-hmm. And then we created character cards to sort of match the personalities and strengths of those of us who actually play. So for me, there was a Johannes Stauffer card, and we put pictures of various sloths on them for some reason. I don't know why, but it was awesome.
They were funny.
Don't you judge me. You don't know my life. But so where for sake you guys comes from is, I think you wrote mine and I wrote yours. Was that how we came down to that?
I think so, yeah.
This is actually a little rules lawyery of me, I think, maybe. But there are a lot of times where, you know, you're trying to accomplish a goal and no one else would be able to do it. And I would just be like, come on, you guys. And I would just have to do it myself.
Well, two, the other thing that would happen that created this rule or this special ability on the Johannes card was oftentimes we would be sitting there taking our turns and he would just go, no, that's wrong. Do X.
That sounds like something I would do and say.
Yeah. Or point us in a direction in a vigorous and profane manner, you know, happened a lot. So the for f- sake you guys rule on his card allowed him to re-roll an action that we had just taken.
That any other player had taken.
Using his own abilities, as though he had swooped in and said, you moron, let me do it.
Yeah.
It was pretty great. It was pretty thematic. We laughed a lot. And that's, let me tangent here.
Yeah.
That's one of the things I really like about board games over video games is that you can do that. You can just make your own character card and throw it in and have a good time, and that's just it. It was just a lot of fun. Whereas with a video game, I would have to know how to program.
Yeah, it's a lot harder, if not impossible, to add house rules to most video games.
Yes. Whereas house ruling a board game is not only easy, it's pretty encouraged, as far as I can tell, in the hobby. Like, nobody cares if you do it. Yep. And if they do care, you should probably not be friends with them anymore.
So as a player, this guy, the alternative, less sweary title Tom came up for it was Cardboard Quarterback, which I don't know if that came from somewhere else, but I thought that was pretty good.
It might have come from somewhere else, but I don't remember if it did. But basically, this is the guy when you're playing co-op games who runs the show, who tells you what to do, guides all the other players, or in the best case, guides the other players to do the right actions. In the worst case, just is basically playing the game by himself, except with three other people moving cards for him.
Yeah.
In the best case, it's the for sake you guys, where it's kind of tongue-in-cheek. It's just fun. In the worst case, everybody's just like, why are we doing this? Why don't you just play the game yourself?
Yeah, so it probably comes up almost exclusively in cooperative games, or in, like, competitive games with an allied victory mechanic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So how do you design around that, or should you? There's really no way to, right?
Basically, you can kind of get around it in co-op with hidden information.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, if you don't know what I have in my hand, you can't really, you know, control my turn.
Yeah, that's
and if I'm not allowed to tell you what's there,
it's like in Space Alert, the difference between open hand and hidden hand or any other number of games,
or even if there is, you know, any other kind of hidden information, mm-hmm. that can help mitigate that a little bit. Or you bring up Space Alert, it's hard to Cardboard Quarterback Space Alert because things are happening so fast that, you know, even if you're on your game, it's hard to keep track of enough to run your own turn, let alone the other three players' turn. I like that game so much. I want to play it again.
Yeah.
Why does Alphonse not let us play it?
That's just one of those confluences of different player types that don't work well together in certain game mechanics and game types.
Fair enough.
Yeah. So the Cardboard Quarterback, really, there's no use designing around it. So other than those things we talked about, but even then, it comes down to, you know, I really liked the rule that they wrote for bluffing. Like, can you lie about your cards in Love Letter? And they basically said, maybe just don't play with the sort of person who would lie about their cards in Love Letter.
Yeah, yeah.
They had a much more flowery way of wording it, but I liked that. I thought that was a pretty interesting approach.
I guess the other thing you can kind of do is design, assuming that one player will want that role, and build it into the game.
Mm-hmm.
Like in that, I haven't played it, but that recent XCOM board game that came out.
Yeah, I've heard good things about it.
You know, there's a player who's like the general, I think it is, or something like that, mm-hmm. and is kind of in charge of dispatching the other players and mm-hmm. giving them resources and whatnot. And that's a very Cardboard Quarterback type of role.
Well, even Space Alert has that, right? Because you end up with a... Have we created those roles, or are those built into the game?
The roles are suggested in the game, but they're not really explicitly part of the mechanics. Like the captain is supposed to coordinate things.
Yeah, that's right, because there's a communications officer who's supposed to keep an ear out for the things in the recording.
Right. But they're not... they're more players who are supposed to be responsible for particular things that everybody's doing anyway, because everybody should be listening to the recording.
Right, but having those people both allows for someone to do that. You know, the captain really could be like, no, sure. you told me you have this card, you should play that one. I'm the captain. But yeah, so that exists. That's kind of cool. So it can actually be a mechanic in addition to potentially annoying or...
It's a mechanic I like, honestly. I like the idea. I don't know that we've designed anything that works this way yet, other than Away Team, of which we will never speak again. Away Team was a game we designed that did not work.
It had promise. It could come back one day.
It needs a lot of work.
It does.
And I'm still bitter about it because I did a lot of work on it and then it fell apart.
Well, so there's another game that we have played. Well, I played more than you have, but called Space Team.
I like Space Team.
Space Team is a wonderful mobile application that you should purchase right away, whether or not you intend to play it, because the developer deserves your money.
The Mildly Alarming Podcast is brought to you by Space Team.
Oh, if only. It's great, and you're controlling a spaceship. We did this in Artemis too. Artemis is another wonderful
Mildly Alarming Podcast is brought to you by Artemis.
Yeah, by Thumb something. Artemis is great. These are games where you're cooperatively controlling a starship, controlling different panels. And Artemis is a lot more Star Trek. You've got an engineer, you've got a weapons officer, you've got a pilot, and we ended up with more people than we had stations. So we first, the captain is sort of an existing one. Mm-hmm. You know, try to drive the ship without having a thing in front of you. Like, but then we had so many people, we ended up with an XO like.
Yeah, because like the captain in Artemis is one of the coolest experiences I've had in games. Excuse me,
Rick, who is not even my brother, who is not even listening to this podcast, and probably my dad, not listening right now, may not listen at all. They are twitching, their ears are burning, they are mad that we're even talking about this game.
So in Artemis, each player has a laptop in front of them, or a computer of some sort, and then you've got a main screen which you use like a TV or something for.
Ideally.
The main screen is like your viewer on the Starship Enterprise that you're cruising around, and each computer is running one station on it. So the science officer has all the science tools on their screen, the helmsman has all the helm tools, and so on. But the captain doesn't get a computer.
And at least as we played, yeah.
As we usually played. And even if they do, they usually don't have access to a lot of information on their screen. So they have to rely on the other players telling them information, and by asking good questions of those players to get what they need to coordinate those, because those other players, each individually, don't have the information they need to do their jobs.
Mm-hmm.
The engineer is useless unless somebody's feeding them information about where to send power at a given point.
If you don't say, we're going to warp, he doesn't know to give adequate power to the warp drives.
Yeah.
And you don't say we're about to turn, and he doesn't know to give adequate power to the maneuvering thrusters.
It was so cool trying to clumsily coordinate with each other the first couple of games, and then after every game, sitting down and going, okay, when I say, you know, we're gonna go to warp, I'm gonna count down three. On two, you do this move. On one, you do this move. You know, we're going to count down jumping this way. This is what this means. And coordinating that stuff and kind of getting that teamwork going was hell of a lot of fun. But you were talking about the XO role we came up with.
Yeah.
We wound up with more players than we needed one night. And the XO, the executive officer we added in, was responsible for coordinating something.
So the captain basically took the overarching, like, okay, we're going to go here and try to accomplish this goal. We're going to try to take out that fleet of attacking aliens. We're going to try to refuel at this station, and we're going to go here. But the XO was in charge of relaying those orders in a meaningful, practical way to the people running the stations. So the captain would say, we're headed to A4, and we're going to attack whatever. The XO usually would have a computer and would try to just use whatever limited map they had to say, okay, we're jumping to these coordinates on my count. You need to have these types of torpedoes ready. You need to be ready on engineering to change the engines and the weapons to this and whatever. You know, you at comms need to be ready to start asking for surrender as soon as we start attacking ships. Science, make sure we know what all their shield types are. Like, there's all these things going on. So the captain was able to step back a little bit, not have so much in his head other than this is what we're doing, and the XO took it to a more granular level.
By taking some of that off the captain's shoulders, you allowed the captain player to stand there looking stoic.
Hands on hips.
Much more effectively.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Chest out.
Oh, yeah.
Shoulders back.
Or doing the lean forward with kind of the hand on the chin move.
Kind of like the thinker.
Yeah, that's a good one, too. That was a fun game. We should play it again.
We should, yeah.
Yeah, a lot of fun. And it illustrates kind of a cool way you can take these different player roles into account and different like levels of player engagement, levels of player intelligence, just types of players, you know, give them different jobs. Like in Artemis, probably the most involved job was the engineer. And like that was hard when you were the engineer. That was a difficult station to run. And the easiest one was comms, probably.
Comms is almost too easy.
Almost, yeah. But like, we had friends that didn't play games much who would come and join in, and we could give them comms, and like that was fun.
Yeah,
they at least they reported having fun during the after battle debriefings that we held, and some of them were court-martialed for failure in the line of duty in the Terran Space Navy, and some of them were taken out back and shot.
Some of them were launched out of an airlock.
Yeah, but you know, it sacrifices had to be made.
It's true.
That was a good game.
So that was a tangent that I adore, and you'll have to listen to even if you hate it. But we got there because we were talking about the cardboard quarterback, the guy who jumps in and basically tells everyone what to do. And in that case, that's a player that is supposed to exist. And in the case of Space Team, where we're all shouting commands at one another, just a little taking a step back and having one person who's like, okay, my command is going to be the top priority just to get us back in a cycle that makes any sense. Or I can be like, hey, wait, you skipped that guy. That's helpful. So those are some video games that you can house rule. That's pretty cool. But that's a strength of board games, that you can add those house rules. You can add, you know, sort of tiered player interaction that you couldn't necessarily do with most video games. So that player type isn't necessarily bad, and you don't have to design around it, but you have to be aware of it, and you need to take it into account if it's something that is likely to happen in your game.
There's a board game, I think it's not Axis and Allies. It's another World War II strategy miniaturesy game. I can't think of the name right now. Hopefully I'll remember it in time to put it in the show notes. But I watched a Let's Play type video of it once, where apparently there's a game mode where you have a player who is your left flank of your army, and a player who is your right flank of your army. And I used the wrong hands when I gestured for those now.
No one can see you. It's a podcast.
But I told them, so now they know. And then you have a third player on each team who is like the over-general, who's responsible for distributing resources to those two generals, like maneuver cards and that. I can't remember the exact resource in the game, but that's another way you can do that, where you have somebody responsible for the grand strategy and distributing resources, and then players responsible for executing on the ground how that's going to go. So you can, to some extent, you can build that into the structure of your game. It's kind of cool. Reminds me of the old Emperor and formats and Magic back when I used to play that back in the day.
Never got into Magic all that much.
You're lucky. It's a bad. It gets into your veins, man.
My brothers both played Magic and would probably never admit that to a person now, but I just put it on the internet, so. Please don't hurt me.
Somewhere their wedgieing hands just, they oiled them up again? Did we do the oil
them
up?
They were gloves last time.
Gloves, okay.
Which seems advisable with the depth and intensity of wedgieing that you seem to be anticipating.
I've met your brothers.
So our last player type that we have on the list that Tom extensively researched is...
I did a lot of work.
The Thespian.
All right, I included this because of a specific incident in a specific game of Eclipse that we played. I was playing as the Mechanima, who are a group of a race of robots.
Is a Mechanima like when a robot does your enema?
No, it's when they give you an enema, but instead of like a liquid they shoot up there, it's a bunch of nanobots that
Grey goo?
Yeah, that pull the poop out. This is a grown-up podcast.
That's horrifying.
That I told you about that new constipation relief method I read about, right?
No, please do.
Okay, so check this out. This is awesome. I read about a way that they've developed to relieve horrible constipation now, where you swallow a little tiny pill. And it's
got... Does it vibrate?
Yeah, well, I'm getting there. It's got a timer in it. So after X number of hours, and X being however long it takes to get to your intestine, it starts to vibrate a little bit way down there in your gut, and it shakes loose all of the poop that's stuck in there. And apparently it works. Like, it clears up your constipation problem.
Yep.
And I thought that was pretty clever. of the people that made it.
Can you imagine how poorly it would go, like, if you got pulled over while driving after having had to take this vibrating enema pill and, you know, like, the police officer's like, what is that? And you're like, it's nothing, I swear. And he's like, what is that? Get on the ground.
Do you think it makes enough noise to be heard, like, through your flesh?
For the sake of this story, certainly.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. So anyway, now that we've talked about vibrating enema pills for a bit, back to board games.
Vibrating enema pill could be a band name.
It should be if it's not.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so we're playing this one particular game, and I'm playing the robot enemas. And I kept, like, adopting a robot voice when I would take my turn and explaining what I would do in this kind of HAL 9000 high-pitched robot voice, just, you know, to kind of lend a little bit of flavor to the proceedings. And eventually, and that is to say, by the end of my second turn, Johannes goes, oh, for the love of God, just take your turn.
That sounds like something I would say.
It was, yeah. So I'm kind of defining the thespian here as the player who roleplays even when he should not roleplay.
Yeah.
Or she should not roleplay.
Well, that's all the player types we have on the list here. Are there any others you came up with while researching them in depth while we've been talking?
No.
Just now?
No.
As you do?
No, I was reading a list of the top 12 cats.
What are they?
Well, they're just like specific cats. So
I don't know, like individual,
like
cats.
Individual unique.
These
cats.
Are the 12 best cats.
These are the 12 that are best. Yeah.
Okay. Did I make the list?
I'll forward it to you.
Okay.
We'll put it in the show notes.
No, we won't. So anyway, if you guys have other player types that we didn't come up with, or comments on the things we had to say or missed, you can hit us up. Either in the comments section at www.mildlyalarming.com, on Twitter at mildlyalarming, or by email at mildlyalarmingshow@gmail.com. And now, a word from our sponsor. The Mildly Alarming Podcast is brought to you by...
Jimmigan's Double Honey Spruce Gum. Jimmigan's is the only spruce gum with double honey. Jimmigan's, it's what's for dinner.
What are you doing, Mr. Butthole? What are you doing? What are you doing?
Okay, so we're back from the break, and Tom is presumably talking to his cat. He wasn't making eye contact with me, so I don't think I'm Mr. Butthole.
No, that's the cat.
I'm not Mr. Butthole. That's good to know. So for this section, we're going to talk about a game mechanic, sort of, that I found in an article on Our Board Games, as is my wont, about different methods of shuffling cards. And it's on a website called Dojo of Lies.
Oh, I thought that was Doju Flies.
It does look like dojuflies.com, but if the banner at the top of the website is any indicator, and I'd like to think it is, it's Dojo of Lies. So he
But if it truly is the Dojo of Lies, can you trust it?
Well, take this section with a grain or eight of salt.
I'm going to refer... Salt by the grain?
That's a good question.
I mean, rice I get, but salt, no.
Yeah. It's not even a grain.
I eat salt.
Is salt a grain? Are there salt farms?
I eat salt by the lick.
We can't be friends anymore.
I'm astonished it took this long. All right, so shuffling. Different shuffling methods. Randomization of cards. Obviously important in situations where you have cards that need to be randomized.
We're probably going to be referring to the author as he and him. It's a name in some sort of language that is not English, so it might not be a man, and I'm terribly sorry if that is the case. But we're going to assume man, yeah? Or I could use male pronouns and you could use female pronouns. That wouldn't be confusing at all.
No, not even a little bit.
All right.
We could use the author. We could use they as a third-person singular gender-neutral pronoun. But, you know, they as a gender-neutral singular pronoun has a long and proud history in English, and it's really... It doesn't make sense that we don't just accept it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's been used in a lot of fairly high-profile works over the centuries, and it's a fairly, I wouldn't say recent innovation, but it's strange that it's unusual that it isn't just like, yeah, that's fine.
Well, yeah,
it should be fine.
How can you be obnoxiously pedantic if you can't say they? How many people are you really talking about? It's like when you ask the teacher if you can go to the bathroom and they say, I don't know, can you?
See, I always thought the appropriate response to that was just to wet yourself on the spot.
Yeah, it is. That is the correct response.
I'm going to teach that to my children.
So anyway, this is an article about shuffling cards.
And it is now. Okay.
Various methods.
You know, the thing that surprised me most about this one, like the first method they had was this, the Hindu shuffle, as they call it, where you put the cards in your hand kind of horizontal-like, and then you just pick up a chunk, move it to the other side, and then just keep doing that.
It's the easy way to shuffle. It's pretty much the only way I can shuffle without destroying a deck of cards.
And that one didn't surprise me that it didn't do a great job of truly randomizing the cards. Like, it moves them around, but cards that were near each other before will
are going to be still near each other.
Yeah. So, like, you're only going to use that if you either can't handle a more detailed form of shuffle, or you don't really care all that much.
So the Hindu shuffle is the only way I'm really capable of shuffling without destroying a deck of cards, and it's abundantly clear, even if you don't think about it, if this is the way that you shuffle in a deck builder like Dominion, you realize pretty quickly this is not separating your cards out well.
Right. You get clumping in there and that kind of a thing, yeah. What kind of surprised me, though, was that, and maybe it shouldn't have, but I never gave it any real serious thought, was the riffle shuffle, the classic, you know, split it in half, put one hand in each, fan them with your thumbs, let them go to town move, mm-hmm. Doesn't actually shuffle all that well. Like, it moves itself back to its original starting formation fairly quickly,
mm-hmm.
and it doesn't randomize as well as you would want it to. I mean, it does a pretty good job, enough to get you by in most games, but if you're looking for true randomness,
mm-hmm.
it's not as good as, you know, you might think.
Yeah, I had read that before, and I had read that, you know, X number of shuffles with a given style will eventually return you to virtually an identical deck to what mm-hmm. you started with, but I'd never really thought all that much about it. So, it's interesting to see the breakdown in the charts here.
Well, and the other thing, too, is that with the riffle shuffle, I think, and I don't remember because I read the article a couple of days ago, and I haven't gone back to it in detail, but I think that the author is talking about doing it correctly where it alternates the cards.
Almost exactly?
Almost, if not exactly.
Okay.
But I have never riffle shuffled that well.
I don't know that anyone has.
Yeah, I don't know that it can be done without manually alternating the cards, you know, by taking them out and setting them in a stack. And if you don't do it correctly or close to correctly, if your riffle shuffle game is weak, as it were, you're still going to get clumping, and you still run the risk that it's going to clump up certain groups of cards, and that cards that were close together before are still close together afterward.
You know, a good way to prevent clumping is a good conditioner and a fine-tooth comb. I have no idea what I'm talking about.
I really, really don't know what you meant there at all.
I was thinking hair.
Does your hair clump?
I don't know. Does hair clump? It sounds like a thing.
I've never noticed my hair clumping.
Or maybe you don't want to prevent clumping because you're talking about cat litter.
Although, you know what? Speaking of hair...
can we?
Do we?
Yes, let's.
I was going to talk about dandruff shampoo for a minute.
Okay.
If you really want to. Otherwise, we can go back to shuffling.
Do you have clumps of dandruff?
Listen.
No, let's go there. Come on, bring it.
Listen, my comb is disgusting.
I bet.
No, I used Head and Shoulders for years to prevent dandruff. Turned out not even necessary.
Yeah?
Like, I stopped because I didn't feel like buying it.
You started using your own urine?
I just started rubbing butter into my hair, and it's fine.
Yeah?
Yeah.
You don't need conditioner either with butter.
Not with butter.
It's natural, and that means it's better.
I do have a severe bee problem, though.
Yeah. Bees, they're attracted to butter?
There's, like, sweet stuff in it, isn't there?
Okay, so moving on to shuffling.
Yeah, so riffle shuffle, I mean, you know, if you can do the riffle shuffle, it's probably good. The sleeved side shuffle is very similar to the Hindu shuffle and runs into a lot of the same problems. Its difference is that, you know, you can do it when the cards are in sleeves because it's to the side instead of vertical, I think.
Well, this looks much better than the, considerably better at randomization than the Hindu shuffle, but it requires that the cards be in sleeves. I think because the sleeves slip more readily. So basically you take it in one hand as though you were doing a Hindu shuffle, but then you take the other chunk of cards that you're going to shuffle and you start with the corners and you kind of work them in between the cards. So you're sort of halfway between the Riffle Shuffle and the Hindu Shuffle as far as getting the two half decks of cards that you're shuffling together interspersed between one another. And you do that a few times, and if you try to do that without the sleeves, they don't slip in between one another so well. They have rounded corners, so they just kind of end up hitting against the side, one deck against the other, and you end up tearing up your cards pretty bad. So without sleeves, you really can't do it, which is probably why it's called the sleeved slide shuffle.
True.
One would assume.
But it, you know, randomizes a little bit to some degree. The best one I think this person found, our noble author, was the pile shuffle, where you separate the cards into some piles, and once they are piled, the piles are piled up back into the deck.
Mm-hmm.
And so you might say, like, if you separate the piles out, if you have a 60-card deck and you separate it into 60 piles and then randomly repile them, you've essentially randomized your deck at that point.
Right. And
to some degree.
That's what I try to do when we start a game of Big Man, or what, especially since those cards are... Big Man's a game we're working on, and so our cards are made of card stock, and they don't shuffle well to begin with. And I'll separate them out into a bunch of piles and just try to randomize them as I go, but it takes forever.
That's the problem with it. And that's why you obviously can't do it in the middle of a game, because then you become that slow player that everybody is silently wishing would have a stroke on the spot and die.
Yeah.
But you can certainly use it. Like, I used to see this used a lot when I played Magic at the beginning of games or in between games. You'd see people over on the corners of the room quickly pile shuffling their deck to re-randomize mm-hmm. it and break up clumps of cards that didn't need to be clumped and that kind of a thing. So it's a good way to achieve initial randomization, but it just takes too long to use in the middle of a game.
Mm-hmm. So anyway, that's a pretty decent breakdown, and obviously this lengthy article with many helpful diagrams gives you a much better idea of how this works. But we'll post it in the show notes. And
I guess my question for the committee at this point would be, how much do you care about randomness in a given card game? Like, and I think it's worth talking too about the point the author brings up on a philosophical level about whether true randomness is actually possible, or if we live in a purely deterministic universe where all effect leads back to a cause and there is no randomness. And we are simply the result of previous actions playing itself out.
And also, I think, a much deeper question of, are horses pretty?
No, they're not. And that's the Mildly Alarming Podcast for this week, ladies and gentlemen. You can find us at mildlyalarming.com. Hit us up on Twitter at mildlyalarming, or send us an email at mildlyalarmingshow@gmail.com.
Particularly if there are shuffling styles that we missed or other things that you would like to point out to us, please do that. God, that was terrible.
It's fine. The internet will still love you.
No, it won't. They hate me so much.
Good night, everybody.
Good night. If you suffer from workplace boredom, difficulty sleeping in class, or general feelings of ennui, the Mildly Alarming Podcast may be right for you. Side effects of the Mildly Alarming Podcast are uncommon and include headache, nausea, vomiting, lupus, dizziness, lycanthropy, heavy petting, and an inability to control your jowls. Do not use the Mildly Alarming Podcast if you are pregnant or have ever been pregnant, as it can cross the placental barrier well into the 23rd trimester and has been known to cause irreversible paralysis of the brain-mouth filter. Ask your doctor today if the Mildly Alarming Podcast is right for you.